When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast. I'm Vas Christodoulou. This week's guest is a familiar voice to podcast lovers. Greg Jenner is the host of the BBC's chart-topping history podcast, You're Dead To Me, and the historical consultant of the Horrible Histories TV show. He joined me to talk about his new book, Ask a Historian, which is every bit as funny, informative, and delightful as fans of those shows would expect. Please be warned, this episode has occasional cursing and is not suitable for kids. Greg, you are not the first historian to appear on this show, but you are the first one who is both a professional historian and really, really good at writing jokes. Given that history itself isn't exactly a barrel of laughs, can you tell us how you came to occupy this particular niche and how you're able to use bleak material in your comedy?
Right. So yes, you've had Sir Simon Sharma on, who's a proper historian and one of my all-time sort of great influences. So I immediately pale into insignificance against him. But my background, I suppose, is a little bit different to most historians in that I have always loved history, always wanted to be a historian from, you know, a pretty young age, from late teens probably. But my passion was always comedy. Growing up, that was how I accessed a lot of my historical joy and passion, was through comedy about the past. So Blackadder, Monty Python, The Goon Show, you know, quite a lot of my dad's influences, actually. And in the mid-90s, it was Eddie Izzard, who's a sort of genius and does lots of funny riffs on history and archaeology and, you know, big grand stories. And so I kind of experienced historiographical thinking through the lens of joke writing and through stand-up and through sketch writing and film. So by the time I got to university, and I studied archaeology and history undergraduate, and then did my master's in medieval studies, and even by that point knew that my interests were a little different to other historians. I'd already spotted I was a little bit of a weirdo, because I was using Simpsons references and South Park jokes in my essays, and sometimes my lecturers would say, this is a good analogy, and sometimes they say, this is inappropriate for an academic essay. But actually, I was always finding kind of tropes and stylistic or technical analogies that were, I found to be really rewarding and really interesting and ways into exploring the past. You know, I wasn't doing it to be flippant and silly. You know, when I read Chaucer, you know, I was going to be a medieval lit specialist. That was going to be my thing, but I couldn't afford my PhD. But the idea would have been to do a PhD on medieval romance literature. So specifically Arthuriana, Chaucer and so on, looking at jokes. I would have been looking at comedy and satire, the subversive, the anarchic, you know, which is classic Chaucer, all the sort of bathos and farts and sex and you know, yeah, power and old men falling over. It's sort of
basically just a bunch of dirty jokes.
It's filthy. It's filthy, and it's highbrow filth, isn't it? It's, you know, on the one hand, it's this sort of noble and grand literary canon. On the other hand, it is slapstick and violence, yeah, and gore and weird jokes and women cheating on their husbands, you know, in a sneaky way. So I had a kind of a comedic bent already as a student. During my master's, I pivoted slightly away from the kind of Arthuriana in terms of the literary canon, and I started looking instead at the reception of it in popular culture. So my master's thesis was on films about King Arthur, because I was starting to understand that actually that's what I thought was really quite unique and quite interesting about this story, was that here we have this tremendous literary cycle, and you know, you have the sort of the French Vulgate cycle, and then you have the sort of English later version of it, and the Malory is the probably most famous English version, the Morte d'Arthur. But what was intriguing to me was that cinema could not let go of this canon and kept reinterpreting it, kept exploring it, and kept reviving elements. And there was a really interesting intellectual and cultural history but also there was a tension in there as well, because I was quite quickly aware that historians get very defensive when a film is made about their period. And historians are people of culture. We love movies and art and books, of course we do. And many of us consume and enjoy fiction and narrative storytelling about history. But when it's on our period and when it starts to tread on our specialism, we get very sort of tetchy and a little bit sort of like, well, no, they didn't get that right. And so my master's thesis ended up as this sort of weird Frankenstein's monster, which was that it was an exploration of how cinema interpreted these classic Arthurian texts, but also how historians responded to them, how medievalists reacted to their turf being trod all over by Hollywood and its big old budgets. And so, you know, aged 22 or whatever, 23, I was already quite deep into the quagmire of debating issues of accuracy and ethics and who owns stories, who owns the past, who controls the past. You know, are historians curators? Are we gatekeepers? Are we public servants? Does accuracy matter? Does the public have a right and a duty to be told what is true, what is not true? Can Hollywood do what it wants? All these sort of ethical, you know, questions and conversations. And moreover, I was really fascinated by the way that each generation of filmmaker or storyteller sort of took a medieval idea or medieval stories and repurposed them to reflect current concerns. So you can look at the kind of, obviously this Excalibur, the John Borman movie. You can look at Lancelot du Lac by Bresson, which is a very difficult, austere film. You can look, obviously, at Monty Python's Holy Grail, which is the best of all of them. And actually, medievalists agreed. I surveyed 100 medievalists and they all agreed that Python's Holy Grail is the best Arthurian film because it's really funny and weird and bizarre and violent. And then so is Mallory. It's full of bizarre violence. So that was my routine, you know, comedy, culture, but increasingly being aware that actually history is used in a creative way. It's used by the public, by storytellers, and that we, most of us, engage with the past, not through great literary tomes of, you know, sort of 700 pages of historiographical writing by professors, but actually through Downton Abbey and Poldark and Tom Cruise movies. That's sort of how most of us engage with the past, through pop culture. So I was slightly evangelized by this point. And funnily enough, you know, at the time, I was a bit of a weird radical in my department, and they weren't quite sure what to do with me. And they had to convene a special panel to mark my thesis because they were like, this isn't really medieval studies. This is something else. And I was like, well, no, I think it is medieval studies. I think it's about medievalism. I think it's about how the medieval is used and understood now. And they were like, all right. So there was a slight reluctance. And ironically, now there's a huge amount of work into this area. And I think I was perhaps relatively early adopter, and now I get invited back in the same university where I studied, York, which, you know, I love very much, but they very kindly have me back quite often to teach students there or to lecture or to discuss these issues. And Royal Holloway sometimes invites me back in as well. So it was a sort of interesting journey, because I felt like a bit of a weirdo in my department at the time, but I guess in some ways I was a little ahead of the curve. But also I was doing quite a lot of work into these really important questions that when I ended up in the television industry, which is, you know, I couldn't afford my PhD, that was the next move for me. Was I wanted to go into the most influential place where I could shape and try and, you know, without sounding too big-headed, try and improve slightly the quality of historical information that was being given to the public. Because at the time, and it's a lot better now, but at the time, this is 2005, there were essentially three historians on British television. They were David Starkey, Simon Sharma, the brilliant Simon Sharma, and Bettany Hughes would be allowed like one program a year. But she was a woman and they didn't really want women on telly doing history because, you know, it's a man's game. That was the sort of the logic. And so a lot of history programs were presented by Jeremy Clarkson and by, in fact, you know, one of the most prominent history presenters of the time was Richard Hammond from, you know, there were two Top Gear presenters who were doing quite a lot of history shows. And there were a lot of celebrity vehicles, Joanna Lumley or, you know, sort of actors or people from Coronation Street doing celebrity style journeys into the past, which is still a legitimate form of history. But there were so few programs on television in 2005 made involving a historian. you know, either presented by or written by or even consulted, you know, even just, you know, sitting there and going, well, you probably can't do that. And it felt to me like there was a bit of a paucity or, you know, a big old a gap, really. And actually, I got quite lucky that I sort of came into the industry in 2005, very junior, but quite quickly rose up because I was quite rare having a master's degree. Everyone was like, oh, you're, look at you with your master's. And now everyone has a master's, but at the time it was quite rare. And actually things really improved quite quickly. And now, you know, you can throw a stick in a historical party full of historians. And actually 10 of the people in the room will probably have been on television. So, you know, we now have lots of scholars who regularly present things, you know, Lucy Worsley and Yanina Ramirez and, you know, Mary Beard, obviously is the most canonical, but, you know, Susanna Lipscomb and Helen Castor and lots of people are given platforms to share their work. And that's much more encouraging. So I joined the TV industry because I felt that there was a bit of it just felt like it was too much of an entertainment genre and it wasn't quite working with historians enough. Once I got into telly, documentary was sort of interesting for a bit, but I then quickly found that actually my interests were drama and comedy because of course that seems to always have been my bent. And so I got very lucky that I got to work on dramas, historical dramas for a couple of years, which was really influential, really interesting. So a lot of that intellectual work I'd done as a student about who controls the past, what is accuracy, does it matter? Well, suddenly I found myself making dramas where I was having to have these debates with myself. You know, you're having your own internal argument about, can I do this justifiably? Is this is this too far of a stretch? Is this too much of a poetic license? And then I ended up on Horrible Histories through pure luck. And for your listeners who perhaps aren't familiar, Horrible Histories was a huge TV series now, but at the time was a kind of ludicrous gamble, a really, really, a very, very kind of radical idea based on the book series by Terry Deary, which had sold 20 million copies. You know, they're a huge book series, but the books are very distinctive. And we were going to do a comedy sketch show based on them in the style of Monty Python. But the difference would be that everything you saw, everything the children saw, would be factually grounded. And so they weren't going to have a historian on the show. And I sort of talked my way onto the program. I was in the building at the time making a documentary about castles or something, some random, you know, sort of England's finest gardens, something like that. I can't remember exactly. And I sort of knocked on the door of my boss and just said, Richard, I love comedy. I grew up on Python and Blackadder. I wrote my master's thesis on Monty Python. I know how to do this. You know, I'm not experienced. I've never worked in comedy specifically, but I can help with this. Please give me a job. You know, I'll do the photocopying. I'll make the tea, but this is the dream job for me. I'm a historian who loves comedy. And he was like, all right, sure. I was expecting a much bigger battle, but he was like, yeah, okay, it's probably a good point. Actually, we weren't going to have a historian, but it's probably useful to have one. And so I got sort of kind of seconded really onto this extraordinary experiment, which was we were going to make a comedy sketch show for children aged 7 to 11, where we were going to tackle violence and gore and weirdness and medicine and food and fashion and all of those things that make history surprising and bewildering and foreign sometimes. But we were going to use 21st century aesthetics, jokes, songs, parodies, TV show spoofs to try and close the gap between the past and the present and to give children a way into the subject. And that was 2008. We were a extraordinary, you know, very expensive, very strange show. The BBC were very supportive, but also very nervous because we were going to do like properly violent violence and we were going to do really weird stuff and there's going to be poo jokes and all sorts. And yeah, we've ended up as this sort of huge success, which has been amazing.
There is another dimension to this, which is that historical jokes, i.e. jokes from the past about their own period, are very rarely still funny. Why is that? Are there any historical jokes which are actually still good, or are they all completely unpalatable to us?
I love this question, and I have addressed this in my new book, Ask a Historian, because as someone who loves comedy, I'm fascinated by the history of comedy. And so there are, obviously, through the ages, there are jokes that we can recover. The oldest joke in the world is from Bronze Age Sumer. So it's, you know, over 4,000 years old. And it's a fart joke, which immediately you go, hooray, good. Okay, it's good to know that people have always done fart gags. And it's written in cuneiform. And, you know, it's it's got a sort of double negative in it, so it's not quite funny by our standards, but the joke, I think, is what's something that's never not happened, a wife not farting in her husband's lap. So it's a sort of gag that works better as a kind of, almost as a kind of sitcom. You kind of have to visualize it, actually. It doesn't really work as a punchline. It's more something you have to imagine her sitting in his lap.
It's almost funny.
It's nearly there, isn't it? But someone asked me, what's the oldest joke book for the book? And so I was sort of looking around, and in my head I was thinking, well, maybe it's Aristophanes, you know, maybe it's Plautus, you know, one of these sort of great ancient writers who specialized in gags. But we don't have joke books, and we don't have the famous joke book that was commissioned by Philip of Macedon, father of Alexander the Great. He commissioned the 60 Club, who were these 60 very funny sort of Athenian philosophers who did gags, and he commissioned them to write down their best stuff and send it off to him, which is probably the earliest joke book, but we don't have it. So the earliest joke book we have is called the Philokilos. Philokilos meaning the laughter lover, and it's from about 1500, 1600 years ago, so late antiquity, written by two people who we know almost nothing about. They're kind of very minor writers, but it's got about 265 joke sort of structures in it, and some of them are funny. I've tried in the book to make a few of them into sort of modern English. A few of them made me chuckle. They're reliant on stock characters. So there's a lot of idiots. There's a lot of sort of really stupid idiots, and there's a kind of avaricious men and arrogant men. But the idiot jokes are the best ones. So I guess a classic joke from 1,600 years ago is, I'm trying to forget the exact wording, but something like, "Doctor, doctor, when I wake up in the morning, I feel terrible and have a headache, but I feel better after half an hour." And the doctor says, "All right, we'll wake up half an hour later then." And it's not the best joke in the world.
It's a classic dad joke, isn't it?
It really is. And I mean, a medieval joke from 1511, or rather early modern joke from the reign of Henry VIII. This is from a book called The Demandes Joyeuses, or the Joyous Questions or Riddles. And it's a riddle book, actually, but this one functions as a joke. And that would be, "What is the cleanest leaf in the forest? Holly, because no one dares wipe his arse on it." So it's a bum joke. It's, you know, another classic. But there are lots of constructions in these jokes which sort of still work, actually. It's sort of idiots being idiots. And I think when you then look at the modern versions of that, in English culture, we have, you know, stupid Irishman jokes, which, you know, when I was growing up, was a real trope. I mean, these days, you know, everyone agrees it's racist and we don't do it so much. But when I was a kid, you know, you're exposed to a lot of those kind of jokes still from my dad's generation of, you know, like a stupid Irishman, you know, does this, or, you know, a tight-fisted Scot does this. So the idea of kind of tropes about certain peoples is something that runs through comedy and goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. So that was interesting. And it was, you know, it's definitely fun to see what people laughed at. A lot of the jokes are about enslaved people in Roman times, which is actually, you know, for us is a bit awkward. And we also see, you know, 19th century jokes are, you know, that they're much more proximate to us in time. You'd imagine Victorian era jokes would work more easily because we're speaking roughly the same language as them, obviously. But they're actually harder, I find, a lot of the time. They're so wordy and they're so kind of clumsily constructed, or maybe not clumsily, maybe overly constructed, that they're really hard to penetrate and they don't really work as jokes.
Can you tell us a Victorian joke?
Oh, I mean, they're so difficult sometimes. I can't even, what I can do is recommend somewhere to go and find them. So there's a wonderful Twitter account called Victorian Humour, which is run by an academic called Dr. Bob. And he is, he's a specialist on 19th century newspapers and comedy. And he just publishes all these bonkers jokes he finds in Victorian newspapers. And they're so bewildering and difficult, and they're very pun based, and they don't really work for us now. But one Victorian joke that we do still use is, "Why did the chicken cross the road to get to the other side?" And that is, it's a joke that was actually part of a wider remit of joke. Long story short, it's a punchline joke, which means that it's not designed to stand alone as a joke on its own. it's meant to come after lots of very difficult riddles. So the idea is that you set someone up with the expectation that this is also a very difficult riddle. You tell them 5-6 very hard riddles. They tease it out. They kind of go, oh, I don't know. And you finally come to your sixth one and say, why did the chicken cross the road? And the person's going, oh, I don't know. Is it a pun? Is it some sort of literary reference? Is it something to do with the Iliad? And then you go, to get to the other side. And they go, oh, you bastard. And it's that joke that is, that we only have the joke now. And so we tell it as an anti-joke, which means we tell it as a joke, which the kind of bathetic collapse is the whole purpose of it. But it was designed to be a kind of relief, a release of tension at the end of several other really difficult riddles, so that you're kind of hyped up, desperate, trying to solve this puzzle. And then they go, ah, get to the other side. And so that's a trope that we see in earlier jokes. So the De Mon Joyeuse, this book from 1511, has some of those anti-jokes as well. There's a terrible one, which is, how can a man perceive a sheep in a flock of goats, or a goat in a flock of sheep? Answer, with his eyes. And you go, oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah, that's rubbish.
it's really bad. But the idea is that it's come at the end of several other difficult riddles. And so you're all set to answer this very taxing thing. And then it's like, ugh. So there's kind of what we understand sometimes in terms of comedy is that the past, often we describe people in the past as not being funny, or we describe them as dour, or we call the Victorians prudish and humorless, mirthless. And it's really unfair. But what is important, I think, is that comedy is very cultural, and it's very reflective of mores and concerns, but also of styles of speech and of rhetorical patterns and all sorts of things. But also, of course, it's deeply referential to the events and the news and what's happened that week. And so there is a problem, I think, sometimes that a lot of historical comedy just does not translate. And so we tend to then look at the past and go, well, they're all a bunch of humorless, sort of boring, po-faced, just sitting there going, mmm. But people loved to laugh in the past. And, you know, the fact that there's a textbook called The Philohelos, The Laughter Lover, tells us that actually laughter was a huge part of every civilization, every society. But that doesn't mean that what they found funny, we find funny. And, you know, working on a TV show about comedy, it'd be interesting in 20, 30 years' time to see if people still laugh at horrible histories. They might not.
Your new book, Ask a Historian, is very funny. I can say that unequivocally.
Thank you. It's very kind.
It's very funny in 2021. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Come 2023, it might be awful. Yeah.
Can you give us the elevator pitch for the book?
It's a very simple elevator pitch. As a historian, I'm often trying to figure out what might people find interesting. You know, you come up with an idea for a podcast episode, or you come up with an idea for a TV show or a book, and you think, well, I hope people like this. I hope it's interesting. But on Ask a Historian, I just went very simple, very route one, and I asked people, what do you want to know? So it was, you know, the idea would have been, when I was touring my previous book, Dead Famous, the idea would have been to go around, talk about the history of celebrity for 50 minutes or so. And then the last 10 minutes, I would have opened the floor to let people ask me anything at all about history, which is something I tend to do anyway. But I would have jotted down their questions and gone home and written a proper formal answer, and it would have formed the book. But unfortunately, Dead Famous launched 4 days before the COVID pandemic, so there was no book tour. So I did it online instead, and we got probably 500, 600 answers or questions rather. And then it was a question of choosing the 50 questions which were most interesting, most answerable, had really rich histories, could be potentially funny, could be surprising. Trying to get a spread of global history, because that's something I'm trying to do a lot more of. I'm very aware of my background as someone who's only really studied European history, and so I'm doing a lot more when I can to expand my own horizons and to work with historians who specialize in Asian history and Central American or South American or to African history in particular. So make sure that I'm not perpetuating a very kind of Eurocentric or Western-centric perspective. So the idea of the book really was to try and get a spread of different themes, you know, some food history, some myth-busting, some personal stuff where people ask me my personal tastes, you know, favourite movies or whatever. Some funny ones. Someone asked me a brilliant question of which people from history would you hire for a casino heist, which it was really fun to answer because you suddenly think, oh, wow, yeah, okay, you need a safe cracker, you need a kind of getaway driver, you've got to have some muscle, you need someone to go undercover, you've got to have a kind of, you know, a brainiac, there needs to be a kind of tech person who can break the security. Really fun to answer that. And so as a historian, it's nice sometimes to be set a kind of creative question that isn't necessarily about, you know, did this happen, yes or no, but to still actually have to think through, well, who would you want on your team? And you don't want Stalin, even though he was a bank robber in his youth. I mean, he's clearly going to shoot everyone at the end of the movie, so can't be trusted. So it's about putting together a team of people, you know, it's people like Josephine Baker, who is, you know, incredible celebrity, a phenomenal singer and actress and a beautiful, dazzling star, but also was in the French Resistance. You know, she was capable of being a spy. She was capable of going undercover. But people like Amin Panafer, who was an ancient Egyptian tomb robber, or Diocles, the Roman charioteer, who was the most successful sports person of all time in terms of earnings, you know, he would be the getaway driver because by the sounds of it, he was lucky because most charioteers were crushed to death. It's incredibly dangerous. And he survived thousands of races. So
you didn't want Nero as your charioteer.
No. Well, Nero famously crashed his chariot, but declared that he would have won anyway had he finished. And so he was, at, you know, this was at the Olympics where he raced, I think, with 12 horses and everyone else had 6 horses. But he crashed out, but he sort of stood up and went, well, I would have won. So I think I'm still the champion. And they kind of went, all right.
Didn't people let him win on account of his being emperor? I think they
yes, he did. And he entered all the Olympic events. And the story goes that he comes home with something like 1,800 laurel wreaths or something. You know, like he's competed across Greece in everything and they've just given him all the awards. So yeah, there's a kind of joy to being a historian who gets asked stuff because sometimes it's really easy to just go, well, we know a lot about this and here's the kind of potted history of, someone asked me about the history of meringues and it was really fun to just sort of go, okay, yeah, we know a fair bit about the history of meringues. It's we're not quite sure who invented the name. We're not sure if they're from Meringen in Switzerland or, you know, if they're a French invention, but we know roughly where they start sort of here. And then sometimes people ask you a much more difficult question and it's, you know, when was Monday invented was a question that someone asked. And it's really hard to answer that because on the one hand you go, well, what do you mean? When was Monday invented? Are there not always Mondays? And you think, well, no, of course there aren't. Actually, a 7-day week is a human construction. It's a cultural thing. And so who invented the 7-day week? Oh, okay, well, we could start there. So then you're back into the Babylonian era, but actually they don't necessarily have a regular 7-day week. And the Romans and Etruscans early on had an 8-day week, like the Beatles. And it's actually probably ancient Jews who give us the 7-day week because they had the kind of the rigid 7-day Sabbath. So potentially the Monday might start there, but they didn't really name their days. And so Monday potentially is only about 2,400 years old, which is when we get the kind of Greco-Persian fusion that gives us the astrological system, you know, of Taurus and Cancer and all those sort of astrological signs in the sky. But also the idea of Monday and its name being named after the moon, well, that's obviously later still, because you've then got Moon's Day, and in English, Tuesday, so Tue, the god of war in Anglo-Saxon sort of culture or early Germanic culture, Woden's Day. So again, it depends on your language, but of course the Romans, it was named after the gods or the planets. So a question like that is really difficult to answer because you find yourself going, oh yeah, Mondays don't exist until someone invents them, which is very surprising. And moreover, as a social historian, you know, I finished that answer very briefly by saying the Monday that Garfield hates, you know, Garfield the cat hates Mondays famously, but the Monday that he hates is 100 years old because the Monday he hates is the first day of the week after the weekend when his owner, John, his butler, who gives him lasagna, has to go back to work and leave him alone. And he hates that. And the first day of the week being a Monday is it's 100 years old because prior to that, Sunday was the first day of the week. And before that, it was Saturday. So historically, Monday was the third day of the week, then the second, and now it's the first. And that's to do with the Industrial Revolution and the kind of changing labor patterns that you get through, you know, factories and regular shift work. So Mondays are either 2,400 years old or 100 years old. It depends how you want to measure it. So there's a kind of real pleasure sometimes in being set a difficult question where you can't actually give a definitive answer, but you get to explore a variety of ways of looking at it. And that's something I really enjoy doing.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There is some fantastically weird stuff in here. One person asked you whether it was true that Europeans once snorted powdered mummies, and the answer was not what I was expecting.
Yeah. I mean, this is a thing called corpse medicine, and corpse medicine was quite a big deal in the early modern period, particularly in the 1600s or 1500s, 1600s. And the word mummy, you know, in my head brings to mind janitors wrapped in bandages in Scooby-Doo, you know, the kind of classic Hollywood version of it. But mummy is derived from the Arabic word mumia, which means a sort of a tar or resin that was used to preserve ancient Egyptian mummies. And so there's a sort of interesting history here in the fact that there was medical cannibalism throughout history. The ancient Romans would drink gladiator blood to cure epilepsy. And they might, you know, various Roman doctors recommended drinking a broth made of ground up human bones to restore vitality and health. And there is a long-standing tradition for kings, for example, in, you know, 1500s, 1600s, to, yeah, absorb mummy powder, as it was called. You know, Charles II of England takes mummy powder, or spirit of skull, as it was called. And we know people would make a kind of what they called a marmalade out of bone marrow. And they would flavor it with chocolate sometimes. And so there's this surprising, shocking, alarming history of eating other people as a remedy. And it's not necessarily widespread throughout society. It's not like everyone was doing it, but there is this strand within medical history of certain people doing it. And there is a black market that kicks up in parts of sort of the Spanish world, I think in the 1600s or 1700s, where people are kind of mass producing mummies. They're not ancient anymore. They're just sort of someone who's died that week. And they're being sold as authentic mummy. And we also have the story told by Li Shizhen, the Chinese writer, and he's speaking about Arab culture. And he's saying that in the Arab world, there is a thing called mellified man, where an old man at the end of his life who wants to sort of donate his body almost a sort of organ donation, really, will eat and drink only honey until he dies, presumably of sort of acute onset diabetes, and he is buried and then dug up 100 years later on and consumed as a sort of sweet, delicious medicine. And so you kind of go, wow. I mean, that might not be true, because Li Shizhen is writing about a different society, and he's writing after the facts, and maybe it's a bit dubious, but what an extraordinary thing to do, to donate your body so someone else can feel strong again, and to say, in 100 years time, I will be... you know, the great remedy, the Barocca of my day. So there's a really intriguing history there. And obviously cannibalism goes back to the Stone Age. We know, you know, back in the Stone Age, people, we know excarnated, which means defleshed bones. And it's potentially, that means that they're eating them, perhaps in a kind of ritual religious affair, or perhaps it's simply lunch. We don't know. So it's not totally surprising, but the medical side of it is intriguing. And yeah, I talk, you know, in the book, there's a few medical questions, and another one that's quite surprising is the history of hay fever has a very strong association with the history of racial supremacy theory, like the idea of whiteness and race science in the 19th century. And it's a really, it's sort of a kind of slightly hidden history, I think, actually. You know, many of us get hay fever. I'm lucky not to. I'm asthmatic, but I don't get hay fever. I've got plenty of friends who do. But in the 19th century, it was a sign of advanced, distinguished, masculine, high status supremacy, racial supremacy. And various doctors and scholars and writers claimed that it was something that British people got, not foreigners, you know, proper Brits. And then Americans claimed it as a national source of pride. And it was claimed that, you know, people of white European descent would get it, but not people of African descent, not people of Jewish descent, because they weren't as, you know, inverted commas, sophisticated or advanced as a race. And that it was a sign of great mental strength. You know, so this is a kind of neurological disease that affects people with, you know, bigger brains. So your average labourer or farm worker doesn't get hay fever in 19th century science because they are stupider and simpler and more base than, you know, the well-read man who went to Oxford and enjoys reading John Ruskin's letters. So there's this fascinatingly surprising parallel story with hay fever that in the 19th century, there were people called hay feverites, particularly in the USA, who were proud to have hay fever because it was a sign or a mark of distinction. And they would get together in the Adirondack Mountains, I think it is, and they would, or Adirondack, isn't it, get together and they would have these sort of summer parties, and the Hay Fever Association would get together and they would all kind of network and pal, and it was sort of seen as a bit of an elite club. So there's some really surprising histories. When we look in the history of medicine, we can find things that have these secondary histories that are often not discussed, and that's one of the pleasures of doing a book like that, is a simple question of when did hay fever start can actually get you into a second question of like, well, possibly it's first remarked by Al-Razi, who was a Persian scholar about 1,000 years ago, one of the brilliant minds of the Arab world. He's possibly the first to note it, but by the 19th century, it becomes something else. It's part of this wider kind of supremacy idea of the white Anglo-Saxon race, which is, you know, deeply problematic and dangerous and racist now, and we're desperately trying to undo the damage of that in our thinking. But hay fever seems such an innocent, innocuous thing now. I mean, it's no fun at all, of course, but actually the history of it has a darker, subtle undertone that gets you into something a lot more nasty.
How do you think people in the future will remember the historical period that we're in now?
Right. I mean, that's such an interesting question, isn't it? Because someone in the book asked me, how will we be known? What name will be given to our era? Will we be the Elizabethans?
I think that one's taken, isn't it?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? So there's already the Elizabethans, and we are... I don't know how you feel about it. I mean, do you feel like an Elizabethan? Does that feel like a name that resonates for your life?
No. Not at
no.
all.
I mean, you're a young man. I'm trying to cling to my youth, but I don't feel particularly like that's something that's helpful for us. But as a historian, I often lament, well, don't lament, I often sort of get on my high horse and go, I'm not sure the Victorian era is a very helpful phrase either. I use it, obviously, I've used it on this podcast, I'm sure, but to, you know, if you look at 1837, the technology and culture of the time, and then you look at 1901, the kind of radical transformation in life is extraordinary. The amount of technology that arrives and changes the world doesn't feel like a single era to me. It feels, you know, you've got to split it maybe in a couple of ways. You could split it more than two ways. And again, 1952 to now, are we the same people? Is that the same era? I don't know. It feels to me like you can absolutely make that case. You can go for a kind of long durée style, you know, a huge history and just go, well, look, this is the era of the gradual decline of, you know, the British imperial empire and its colonial influence on the world, or we can look at it as a, you know, through the lens of the Cold War. But I don't know, it just feels to me like that's such a spread that's purely arbitrarily predicated on the remarkable health of one woman, you know, the Queen, who has survived such a long time that we still kind of get to call it her era. But had she, you know, not been so robust, would we tie that all together in one package? I don't think we would we? So I've tried to answer in the book the fact that eras are very arbitrary periodization sort of limits imposed by historians to try and create some sort of meaning, but they are very, you know, they're it's kind of intellectual gerrymandering. You know, it's basically just sort of arbitrarily going border here, border there. But they're really problematic. They're really difficult. You know, what is the Renaissance? When does it start? When does it stop? Does it overlap with the
They didn't call it that, did they, at the time?
Well, I mean, they sort of do. They sort of don't. Yeah, I mean, it's very exactly that. It's medieval people didn't call themselves medieval, obviously, and the Aztecs didn't call themselves Aztecs, and the Vikings didn't call themselves Vikings, and the Chinese didn't call themselves Chinese, really. And so all these labels we apply, you know, the Byzantines don't say, hello, we're the Byzantines. They're Romans, right? So there's all these labels and names and rules and dates that we stick on things. And I start my answer by saying in Horrible Histories, I put all these arbitrary borders on for children watching our show to help them understand the past, but they're very limiting. You know, the medieval period should encompass the early medieval period of the Vikings and the early English, but we treat them separately. And Henry VIII, is he early modern? Is he Renaissance? Is he late medieval? What's that? Even Edward VII, you know, is he? I mean, we call him Edwardian, but like, is it late Victorian? Is it not? I mean, there's all these very slippery rules. And so when someone says, well, what will our era be known as? Firstly, I think it's very unlikely that we can name ourselves, because, you know, typically people get named in hindsight later on. I mean, the Enlightenment is named by Enlightenment thinkers, isn't it? So I think it's Kant probably who gives it its name, or we've sort of gone, yeah, fair enough, fine, you can have that. And the Renaissance sort of has an early-ish heritage, I think might be Vasari who names it, but I don't think we get to name ourselves. It's a bit arrogant. So I suspect future historians will look back on us. And the truth is, you know, we're recording this in the week of the huge kind of climate conference, where all the world leaders are desperately trying to, they've noticed that climate change is happening and gone, oh dear. Oh, sorry. Yes, we were busy. So will we be the screw ups? Will future historians look back on us in a world that is absolutely, you know, just destroyed by climate change, by enormous migrations of people desperately trying to save their lives because the seas are rising and the temperatures are changing and the crops are failing? Are we going to be the generation who just absolutely failed to understand what we were doing to the planet? In which case, are we the fossil fuel generation, or the, you know, the disasters, or just the screw ups? I don't know. It's very hard to know. And of course, I'm 39, and in my generation, the internet just changed the world. You know, when I was 14, I had the internet a bit, but it was just a thing that I sort of mucked about on. But now, internet, smartphones, Wi-Fi, I mean, that's changed everything, hasn't it? It's changed politics, it's changed communication. I mean, you and I are chatting right now. You know, we're not even in the same room, but I can see you in HD. That's a phenomenal thing. So do we live in an era that is 50-something years, 60, 70 years, or do we live in a very small, very tight post-1990 type micro era where the thing that's changed the world is this one revolution, this technological revolution? I don't know. I don't think it's up to us to decide, probably. I think we'll find out in 50 years.
If you could live anywhere at any time, where would you choose?
Historians get asked this a lot, and I think the kind of brave, courageous ones sort of say, oh, I'd love to live in the, you know, 1470s. But as someone with asthma and various allergies, I think I'd die immediately if I didn't go, you know. How many antibiotics am I allowed to bring with me on this journey?
You can take a rucksack full of modern stuff.
Okay.
All right.
I think, I've always been drawn to the Renaissance and that sort of period of history where you get this amazing flourishing of culture. But the, you know, one of the things that's surprising about it is that, as was so brilliantly argued in a recent book by Professor Catherine Fletcher, but the Renaissance is a response to incredible violence. You know, you've got the Italian wars that are ravaging the Italian peninsula, and the Spanish Empire and the French are sort of fighting it out, and Italy is a sort of battleground. And amidst all this, we get, you know, Leonardo and Michelangelo and Raphael and all these sort of brilliant creatives. And it's sort of nice to imagine them just sort of pottering around, doing a bit of art, doing a bit of sculpture. But actually, when you look more closely, you realize that actually there's sort of battles happening out the window. And, you know, Leonardo is trying to build a sort of giant bronze statue, and in comes the Duke and says, actually, I need that for cannons. Sorry. So there's a kind of, I think there's a slight romance to that period, where actually, chances are, if I went back there, I'd find myself being bombarded by, you know, sort of artillery. So I don't know.
Sat in the back with a stiletto, Greg.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Stiletto knife. Yeah. So I, as a very cowardly man, I would not want to go back very far at all. I mean, I've always been drawn to, you know, 1960s because of the music. I'd love to see Jimi Hendrix play. That would be fun. and they did have antibiotics. So that's the sort of cowardly answer. If I'm totally honest, and if I can be protected in my time machine and I get to, you know, I get to dodge all the dodgy stuff, I think it would be extraordinary to perhaps see the fall of Constantinople in 1453, some grand, enormous seismic change to history. I think it'd be amazing to go and see, you know, the first emperor of China, Qin Shi Huangdi, you know, maybe his funeral or something, you know, that extraordinary event. Supposedly, I mean, the story goes that when he died, he was on an imperial tour and they didn't tell anyone. And so his corpse was paraded through the streets and they were like, he's fine, he's fine, he's absolutely fine. And so I think it'd be quite interesting to see that. But I mean, there's so many grand events from history. But, you know, if you're asking me where can I go safely, I'd love to spend an afternoon with Leonardo, maybe somewhere safe, maybe his house in France when he's sort of half retired, just watching him scribbling, pottering around, playing with, you know, helicopters, whatever he was doing that afternoon. That feels like a safe, nice afternoon out. Nothing too risky. Hopefully no battles in the background.
Greg, it's been an absolute joy having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
This week's show starred Greg Jenner and was produced and presented by me. The editor was John Doughty. You'll find more history wherever you're listening to this. Greg mentioned Matt's interview with Simon Sharma, but you'll also find Rutger Bregman, Yong Chang, Simon Sebag Montefiore, and many more in our archive. Until next week, I'm Vas Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.